Accession number 33891.
Reel 4.
Gary Arrett's reel 4. With the cross country, then, did that? I take it that involved a certain amount of navigation, did it? In there?
Yes, but I don't. I'm sorry, I boomed. We didn't do you'll have to delete that, but we didn't do navigation on Tiger Moths.
It was just aircraft handling then, essentially.
Just aircraft handling on top. So we need to correct that. I don't know whether you can delete that little bit. It wasn't until we got onto the Jansons, the next one up, where we had to do navigation, but then there were two of us in the aircraft, always.
So can I ask you a little bit about that, the ground school, what that actually involved in your...
It was, again, more of a little more detail of the theory of flight, what kept an aeroplane in the air. It's still a puzzle to me. There's a piece as heavy as a B-29, 6,000 tanks, gallons of petrol aboard, and 5,500 pounds can get airborne, but it does, because of the way the wind flows over the wings. But primarily engine handling, meteorology, and general aircraft navigation. We didn't do too much about navigation on the Tiger Moth. That really began to concentrate more when we got on to the next aircraft, the Ants.
So it was theoretical, was it?
It was all theoretical stuff, yeah.
Can I ask about meteorology as well? What kind of...
Well,
do you
they were teaching us about cloud recognition, to recognise what was cumulus, and which, you know, and therefore you're going to get bumpy, and what was a cumulonimbus, which is going to be bloody bumpy, and so on, and what was stratus, the results of flying in cloud in cold weather, because if you can have what they called supercooled water droplets, that you could fly in a cloud which has got rain droplets in it, but they're not frozen, it's rain. Your aircraft has been flying and it's ice cold, okay? And your ice cold aircraft flies into these water droplets and turns them into ice radically. And the ice begins to form up along the wings. So you don't want to do that. Perhaps that's something we carry on in the next... Have you never had this sort of description before on some of your other...
But there is one question I can ask you. Here we go. Could I ask as well a little bit about the weather conditions when you were flying? Because obviously it was the middle of winter, but was there... I take it there were clear days to fly with that period.
Actually, the weather during that period, as far as I can recall, was pretty good. We had the occasional snowstorm when everything packed up. No, it was fairly good weather, strangely enough. It's cold, but predominantly, I would say, good flying weather, or adequate flying weather. Maybe an occasion when you couldn't go up and do aerobatics because the cloud was too low, but at least you could do circuits and bumps. Perhaps I would have had my logbook alongside because I could see how many breaks we had, and then answer that question a little more clearly.
How long were you there? Were you there from into the spring period?
No, we were at... we were there from January the 8th till... March, 29th of March we moved on, so it's only January, February and March.
And where did you move on to?
A place called Carberry in Manitoba. Incidentally, the Caron, Saskatchewan, is now Caron Port. It's a Bible, the place has been taken over, it's a Bible school, which is quite a change, isn't it? You know, one of these many... religious sects you get in North America, it's taking over Bible school, and I corresponded with them for a little while when I was sort of checking on these things, and the runways were used to as the basis for the Trans-Canada Highway.
And the next place that you moved on to, was that a specific training school?
Oh yes, this was a service flying training school where we were on Jansons.
So how does that, again, with the process with the Jansons, how does that start?
Well, as I recall, there was far more detailed instruction about the antenna as an aircraft and its abilities and what one could do and the instrumentation and things of that sort. But I think basically it was very much as it was, or rather more divided. There were four pupils per instructors, two flying together in the first session, one sitting in the back while the other one went through and then changed seats and that sort of thing. So you could pick up each other's faults. And then lectures in the afternoon. But when we arrived at Carron, at Carbery, I haven't got any picture of that one, the entrance to the flying training school, above the door, flying training school, the snow was above the level of this patio. You couldn't get in the door. And the hangar was blocked off, and then also I have pictures of the hangar completely flooded as it melted. So the first few days we were there, we didn't do very much flying. And that was in March of
42. Was this a good occasion, though, because obviously it's a twin-engined aircraft. Mm. Had you then been selected for twin-engined training,
or was it? The whole 60... I don't know how the selection was done in the first place, but when we came across on the train, one lot was dropped off at Moose Jaw, which was our nearest railway to Carbery, and they all went to an airfield just north of Moose Jaw and were all on Harvards. So somewhere back in the selection procession, they had been chosen as single engine or fighter pilots, whereas we had obviously been chosen to be heavy duty pilots.
And were you aware of any part of that selection at all, really, until that occurred?
No, it was only when we got back, well, when I got back to Moose Jaw and started thinking about it and realised that some of the bods we were bumping into in the restaurant and the dance hall on a Saturday night sort of thing are people who'd been on the train and the boat with us were now flying Harvards. They must have been selected sometime previously. It just didn't happen. Oh, U60 off here, U60 off there. This 60, as I say, were all joined the ACRC together. So the pre-selection was done by those original and businesses, I would imagine, because I don't see where else it could have been done.
So had they selected potentially a group of people to do that sort of stuff quite early?
Right from the go. That's my opinion, but I can't prove it.
And with you were arriving there, I take it the Anson was a much more complex aircraft than the Tiger Moth.
Oh, yes, it had more instruments and, of course, twin engines, and you had to learn to fly occasionally with one of them not on. Although, again, I don't remember ever having to do... I must look in my logbook, because later on, it was normal practice when you were being trained for Dakotas and things like that. The instructor will shut one engine down as you took off and say, right, you're lost an engine, carry on. I don't remember that happening on an Anson. I'll look in my logbook before you come.
And was there a case that they would, again, familiarise you with the aircraft? Would you be taken around to see all these various...
Oh, you go around. We were taken around the hangar. Were we taken or did we wander around the hangar? We got around the hangar anyway, one or another, and asked questions, or I did, and I think several others did. Incidentally, there is an example of the little white flash that I was telling you about. You can just barely see it in that cap.
So worn on the sort of right-hand side
of
the forage cap?
Side, yeah. No, it was worn round the forage cap, both sides, clipped in that way.
Oh, you see. Sorry, I was thinking of the tilt. Most people wear it tilted, don't they?
If you look at it very closely, you can see his going round the corner.
So... There was an initial delay then of you to you actually getting around to training on the Anson with the
yes
with the snow.
Again, I'm sure we're going to cover that when you come next time, aren't we? I'll get my logbook out and I'll have a look because I've got specifically the date of arrival, which was one day after we left the other place, and I can see what the first day we flew, see what the break was.
So can you tell me again? Give me a sort of. Again, if possible, a thumbnail sketch of the Anson as an aircraft.
Well, it's an aircraft that I got to know extremely well because I flew I think, 6 or 7 different marks of Anson over the years, including one that was converted for VIP flying. It was a very good aircraft. It's made by that old firm from Manchester. It was a sound aircraft. I don't remember anybody ever complaining about rough running engines, about the inability to handle. I personally found it a smooth aircraft to fly, although on one occasion I did get a bit sick from aircraft fumes, which was my fault because I'd left the window over the side slightly open, it was coming in. But no, it was a nice basic aircraft, not too large. Again, there's a picture of it, two of them. Oh, that was the other thing, we learned formation flying.
Was it a stable aircraft?
Very stable. It was an ideal aircraft for training, no doubt about that. It could, for my mind, the other aircraft, the twin engine aircraft that was used for training was the Oxford. Not in Canada, that was used in the UK, and that was a poor aircraft to fly. And that was used later at what we call the beam approach training schools and things like that, that's where I first saw the rope.
Did the Anson have any vices as such as an aircraft, would you say?
No, other than if you'd got into a spin and couldn't get out, you wouldn't get out because of the door was at the back. And it didn't have an internal toilet. I can remember flying somebody in an Anson later on in life who had to have a crap, and he sat on the step, pushed the door open and sat with his bum hanging over. And I know of others who laid the maps out on the floor and held on struts on each side, and the pilot, mainly me, myself, had done that on the control column. But that was very unkind.
But I take it with aircraft at that time, they had very few facilities on board.
Yes, you couldn't prepare a meal on board like you could with the B-29, for example. No, they were very basic aircraft. They only had seats for two pilots and a navigator, and there was no place for a signaller that I recall, although we used to carry signallers later. And no facility. The only facility you had was a what I call the U tube, a tube stuck there you could lift up and pee into. And there, ground crew, if they didn't like it, would turn the outside the wrong way around so it blew back.
And what about heating and facilities like that? Because obviously you're flying in winter conditions there. Did the aircraft have some form of internal heating?
Yes, it did have some form of heating. I don't recall having to get dressed up too much to fly in the Anson. No, that was Tiger Moth's picture of that. And it got warm quite rapidly in March. The spring arrived fairly rapidly, March, April. In fact, as I recall, yes, by the end of the time at Carberry, we were issued with khaki clothing, summer clothing.
Is it a case with the weather, then it goes almost from one extreme to another very, very quickly?
Fairly quickly. But I say, by the end of June, I certainly remember wearing khaki.
Can I ask them, obviously, about facilities at Carberry, what the airfield was like and what your
Carberry
accommodation was like?
Carberry had been operating for some time and was well established. The little town of Carberry was good. You saw a picture of Carron. That was a real hip town. Carberry had a cinema and lots of restaurants and that sort of thing. You could go there in the evening if you wanted to. It was a grown-up town. And then the local town of Moose Jaw, which was fairly easy to get to, was, to all effects, a small city. Had everything. You all right?
And how did you get along with the locals in Canada?
Oh, they were always very hospitable. Always. No matter where you went, have you got anywhere to go for the weekend? And you were invited to their homes and things like that. In later on, where I finished up in Charlottetown, we were more or less two of us were more or less adopted by a village. We spent all our weekends in the same place. But that will come up later. And, in fact, yeah, that was on Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island.
And what about your accommodation at the air?
Always barrack blocks with bunks, always bunks, one up, one down. You used to toss the coin for upper and lower.
What was the preference?
I didn't care quite, kind of. It didn't matter to me. I suppose you could sleep more soundly in the bottom, because if the chap down at the bottom was a bit rough, you did wobble a bit at the top, but wasn't important as far as I was concerned. And in fact, the same applied right the way through into sergeant's married quarters later on, was in bunks.
And I was thinking at Calgary as well, what about discipline? How did that work with you as, you know, aircrew under training, really?
Well, I don't remember anybody ever being put on a charge for any form of indiscipline. No, it's very much like, if you can pick, I would imagine, I've never went to college, but I would imagine it was the same sort of thing as a college with the prefect keeping an eye on you, because you would have a corporal in charge of your particular group. And he was a disciplinarian in his, by, you know, he was that sort of type. But it was generally, I don't know, I think the ground crew had more, the air crew, NCOs had more respect, because they, I think, had a certain admiration for the fact that we had volunteered to start flying, knowing what the risk was.
And were most of the, I'm thinking the airfield staff, or permanent staff there, were they British or Canadian?
Yeah, no, British.
Yeah. Was that still the case with the instructors as well?
All the instructors are RAF. Most of them are people who'd done a tour of ops and were now instructors. Sergeant Pride, my first instructor, had been a Battle of Britain pilot. He was now on his ground job. And the next one had been a Bomber Command pilot. He was now doing his ground tour.
And with instructors, you mentioned obviously there was a slight problem when you two were trying to work out each other's accents.
Well, initially it was, but by the time I think I began to lose my accent fairly soon after arriving in Canada, although it was several years before I eventually got home, I was told off for having a Canadian accent. So somewhere along the line, I must have dropped my Cockney accent. And I didn't get a commission until 1946, by which time I could learn to speak with a plum in my mouth. And I had a CO whose comment when we got to know each other a bit better was, "I don't want any bloody warrant officer on my squadron with more hours in his logbook than my officers. Fill that bloody form in." And that's how I got my commission. That's the history, anyway.
So the instructors were all, they were experienced pilots?
Oh, yes, very experienced pilots. The odd one with a DSC and the odd one with accommodations. No, they knew their job. And
did anybody get on with the instructors, or was there occasions when people might not?
I cannot think of any of my particular compatriots complaining, saying so-and-so's a bum, or worse out of it. No. No, we managed.
So that period at Calgary, obviously, when you arrived, the process was, what was it, one of starting to develop the skills that you'd got at elementary?
Yeah, it was the same sort of thing as before. Circuits and bumps until you were allowed to go solo. Are you doing any more recording or just general chat?